Hi, I'm Chad Hughes, and you're listening to Elevated Access, the inside story. This episode, I met with Glenn Miller, an access professional with 26 years of experience who has worked on some of the most sensitive projects known about. Glenn and I talk about his experience securing access for an offshore gas exploration project off the coast of Cape Breton Island. Glenn shares how his agricultural background helped spark his curiosity for the work that access professionals do. He shares how his career evolved and how the complexity of his work grew as a result. Glenn shares how stakeholder identification and investing the time in getting to know them while finding common ground enabled him to gain support from stakeholders where that support didn't exist previously. He shares practical guidance on how to apply these proven principles from one project to the next. Let's tune in now for the conversation with Glenn. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Hey, Chad. Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. We've got something to talk about today that's going to be quite interesting. You know, oftentimes when I'm talking to our guests about access, we're talking about access in the context of land access. And today we're going to talk about something a little different. We're going to talk about offshore access. I'm looking forward to leaning into this conversation around the Hunt Oil offshore gas exploration project that you worked on off the east coast of Cape Breton Island. From what I understand, Glenn, there's some really major complexities with this project you worked on, and I think it'll shed a lot of light to our listeners. So before we lean into that, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I grew up northeast of Calgary in a small farming community, Acme Bicycle area. I grew up on a mixed grain farm, you know, cutting wheat and calving cows. And I guess one of the things growing up in a farm background, it ingrained in me hard work ethic and, you know, respect for the land. And probably early 80s, we had a well that was drilled on our home quarter, right behind our farm. And it was kind of always, it piqued my interest as to, you know, how that all worked, and probably more on the legal side of how that worked. You know, we farmed that area for years, and here somebody was coming to drill a well there. And so I was really curious as to how that worked, which kind of got me interested in it. And then I ended up going to Olds College, and I took the land program there and graduating in 94. Still 100% sure I wanted to get into the business, but I graduated. And anyway, the summer of 93, I actually was able to obtain a summer position at Amoco Petroleum. The founder of Land Solutions hired me, Ron Vermeulen. So I got to really get exposed between my first and second year at you know, what all this land work was about and what it's really like, the access side of it, you know, obviously doing more miscellaneous type work, rent reviews and damages. And so then I, you know, I finished my second year, graduated in 1994, and started working for a land consulting company that I did my practicum with. Started out leasing freehold minerals and acquiring surface rights in projects in Alberta and Saskatchewan. And you know, I spent a couple of years in the field and then moved to an in-house position with Amoco Petroleum, you know, kind of back where I was, had that the summer role. And that's really where I guess I started getting exposed to some more highly sensitive type projects, you know, working west the number 2 highway, west of 5th Meridian and the Sundre Caroline, Drayton Valley area. Some of these were sour gas projects requiring consultation with various residents and whatnot in the emergency planning zones, and Directive 56 come out, or I guess it was EUB Guide 56 back then, and I think it was 1996, and, you know, kind of opened up the real mandate for proponents or developers to do consultation to get well licenses, you know, beyond just your affected landowners. So, you know, that was kind of where I was exposed to the whole public engagement type process beyond affected landowners. And anyway, then I had an opportunity at a company called Chevron, and I moved there late 90s, you know, was exposed to more Indigenous consultation in Northeast BC and up in the Northwest Territories in Fort Liard. Again, all about accessing land and getting just not the land rights in place, but essentially addressing any concerns that stakeholders, whether it be on Crown or private, but who maybe weren't directly affected, but adjacent or within proximity may be affected. So that's, you know, a bit of my background, you know, kind of how my career started. The on the sour gas side, I got back into that at a company called Newport Petroleum in late 99. We were purchased by a larger company in 2000, Hunt Oil. And anyway, this, you know, we were busy working on level three sour gas projects in the Sundre Caroline area. And my first exposure to a synergy group, the Sundre Petroleum Operators Group, SPOG, we had our sour gas development in actually a separate subcommittee where we had interested community members who participate in that, and we would work through addressing their concerns. Again, you know, and most of those people in there weren't the affected landowners, but adjacent or within emergency planning zones who potentially could be impacted by our development. So it was quite a process, you know, way more consultation, public engagement, and doing land work. What was interesting about that, when this company, Hunt Oil, purchased us, they got inquiring about how we do business in the Sundre Caroline area, why we do it, the need for it. And it rang a synergy internally within Hunt. And they said, you know, we've got these offshore exploration licenses that require some consultation. And they asked me if I'd give them a hand. And that was probably middle of 2000, just shortly after they bought the company I was working for, Newport Petroleum. So I knew nothing about offshore exploration, but I thought, well, let's go down there to Nova Scotia with them and see what it's all about.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I got into this project.
The you're you know, of course, I've been close to your career, have seen you really evolve and elevate during your time doing this kind of work. I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about what maybe what some of the key differences are between dealing with simply access to land and dealing with, you know, a project where the access to land is a very small portion of what you need to do, and the consultation and the public engagement is, you know, 90% of what you need to do. Can you share a little bit some of the key differences, and then also just how you adapted to what I'd call maybe a bit more of a sensitive stakeholder, sensitive project, you know, as you started to get more involved in those things?
Yeah, you know, so the differences are, it's you're really, you know, you're, when you have a project that, you know, has the potential to impact beyond the property boundaries of where you're acquiring interest in land, and the potential to impact other people, whether that be in you know, emissions or noise or, you know, flaring, for example, you know, and how you might conduct some of those operations and the other people, you know, potentially could be impacted. First off, you certainly want to ensure they're notified, but then you also understand if they have any concerns about that. A lot of that has tied into now and evolved into our regulatory process, depends on what jurisdiction you're operating in, and your ability then to actually get that regulatory approval, you know, either in a routine or non-routine fashion, and then be able to execute the project. So, and at the same time, you know, there's a, you know, it was a good neighbor component of talking to people, you know, within a certain radius who potentially might be impacted, who can see it or smell it or hear noise about it. And you want to ensure they understand what we're up to, that, you know, we're a good operator. We're there to protect the public and do a good job. And, you know, like I say, that kind of rolls up into ensuring you also have done the right thing to obtain that license or that regulatory approval to go operate. Mm-hmm. And your second question then, Chad, help me out here again.
How you adapted your approach. Like, there's a big difference between going out and seeing one landowner and signing an agreement to access a piece of land. There's a difference between that and dealing with a special interest group or a dozen residents that are going to be impacted by a project that aren't receiving any compensation. And so my second question was just around, like, how did you adapt your approach, or did you need to, in order to be successful at that more sensitive project?
Yeah. So it's really, I think it comes down to, again, identifying, you know, who potentially could be interested or impacted or have concerns about what the project is. So as we, you know, I'll describe a bit more of the Sydney Bight offshore exploration project in a bit here, but really it's proximity to location. You know, could we be impacting businesses and understanding what that is, you know, how we could be impacting potentially, you know, a fishery business or a tourism business by us conducting a offshore exploration activity, and then, you know, seeking out who those interest groups might be, understanding, you know, explaining our project and then understanding what their concerns might be, continue discussions into how you may mitigate them. So I would say the approaches would be the same. It's just, you know, the individuals didn't have an interest in land per se. They didn't have an interest in land. But they had a livelihood and a business which they relied upon. And, you know, you learn that through good listening and through, you know, good consultation work. Mm. And so the principles, you applied them the same. It's just the legal interests were different and the interest groups were different who had an interest in what we were up to.
Yeah.
Or proposing to do.
Right. Yeah. I like that. Well, let's talk about the East Coast project. Tell us about the project. Just frame it up for us so we can understand the magnitude of the complexity here.
You know, I had to, you know, before I delve into the details, you know, I had to learn a lot about offshore exploration in a relatively quick time frame. You know, the company had acquired two offshore exploration licenses on the east side of Cape Breton, which kind of run from Glace Bay up to Inganish. You know, they, you know, the exploration business, which is why it's exciting, you know, there was a potential to find significant hydrocarbon reserves. And there was some previous drilling done in 1974 and 76 in this area on one of the licenses, the north one. It didn't penetrate the actual interpreted reservoir horizon. And, you know, so, and there was some previous seismic done out there as well. So, you know, they picked these licenses up again on, you know, a potential prospect and thinking, hey, if we can define it a bit better through, you know, additional seismic and then go drill an exploration well and see if, you know, see if that prospect's really there. So what the company was proposing was 31 seismic lines, and these are, you know, these are done, you know, using a large vessel with air guns. They tow behind the vessel. They can acquire the data quite quickly. The air guns shoot a sonic wave, you know, down to the seabed, and obviously that sonic wave penetrates, you know, to a certain distance below the seabed and down to hopefully the horizon thereafter. And then you record the data back up with a recording line. So there's 31 lines of seismic they're proposing, a total length of 2,000 kilometers. the time to actually acquire that seismic, the amount of time would be about 1 month. On the two different licenses, the line spacing was, you know, on the northwest license, the line spacing was about 2 kilometers apart. The southeast one is about 6 kilometers apart. And what was different about this area than other offshore work, you know, such as Sable or other offshore work that was done off of Nova Scotia, this was, you know, what they call in terms of location, it was in the inshore fishery, which was closer to shore, the closest to the shore we'd actually probably get with the vessel and, you know, conducting the seismic work would be about 6 kilometers. But all of a sudden you introduced a potential conflicts with inshore fishermen who made their livelihoods out there, as well as tourism operators who, you know, conducted whale watching tours or whatever. So that was, what our company was proposing to do. And as I said, they were late awarded these licenses in the late 90s. They did apply for a permit to the regulator, the Canada Nova Scotia Offshore Petroleum Board, to acquire this 2D seismic data and prepared an environmental impact assessment. And they had, you know, a bit of information and consultation meetings in some communities that were bordering these licenses. The actual application that they filed to the Canada Nova Scotia Offshore Petroleum Board, and I'll use the abbreviation CNSOPB, because it is a mouthful.
Yeah.
It was delayed due to a cod migration study that was currently happening. And one of the other interesting things is there was a federal election that was happening in November of 2000. And some of the information that they had provided to some of the communities, it had got out there, and there were some current concerns expressed. And as a result of this, just before the federal election in November 2000, it was put into what's called a public review hearing process. And it was announced to look at the effects of potential oil and gas exploration and drilling activities within these exploration licenses. And there was a one other exploration license that was included on the west side of Cape Breton held by a different operator. So they were also part of this process as well. So the tough part that the company that I was working for, Hunt, faced was, well, you know, this has been suspended. Any exploration activities cannot happen until this public review hearing process was completed. So, you know, that's just a high level overview initially, just to summarize. So it was seismic we were proposing initially, you know, and then if you define that prospect better through the seismic acquisition process, it would be followed up with an exploration well, possibly a second one. That was really kind of the scope, it's rank exploration early on, you know, hoping to find potential hydrocarbons.
Would being that close to shore, would the drilling rig platform have been visible from the shore? Would people be able to see it?
Potentially. Depends where you'd actually end up drilling a well. You need to acquire the seismic first to, you know, determine location. It would have been, if I remember correctly, you know, based off of the well it was drilled a long time ago, and assuming you're just redefining that prospect, it could have been 20 kilometers offshore. Can you see that? Maybe. Had the seismic data identified something else quite interesting, it could have been closer. And you know, the seismic program was, like I say, it was kind of spread out, more intense on the northwest license versus the southeast license. But in terms of the spacing was being 2 kilometers apart. So, and then you got to think, you know, well, when do your inshore or a fishery, what time of year does that take place? When does tourism take place? It's generally in better weather, kind of May to September-ish, you know, depending on the season, right? So, which I can get into a bit more of some of our mitigation that we looked at.
So how did you, like, what was it like just to get up to speed? Here you are, you're an agricultural background. Now, I think you were fortunate that in your career, you'd been elevating in your career and dealing with more projects that were sensitive in nature, multiple stakeholder groups, et cetera. So it wasn't like you were going into this completely naive or blind, but there had to have been a pretty steep learning curve for you when you first were introduced to the project. Like, what was that like? How did you deal with that?
Well, it was, you know, certainly outside my comfort zone. There's no question. It, you know, I had to learn a lot quickly. You know, how does a seismic vessel work? How does, you know, an offshore drilling rig work? And understand it enough, you know, from a technical perspective, to be then able to summarize it into public community information brochures and, you know, slide presentations where you can then explain it to, you know, interested stakeholders, those being fishermen or tourism operators, towns and municipalities. And, you know, so I had to learn it really quick. There wasn't a lot of time to learn it. I guess the, you know, and I'll get into a bit of the timelines of the public review hearing process, given that our application was essentially halted until we got through this public review hearing process. We did have time to prepare all the data, so you learn it quite quickly. It was, you know, the other thing was, you know, we're working in a different regulatory jurisdiction under the Canada Nova Scotia Offshore Petroleum Board. We didn't know them. We had some meetings with them to understand their regulatory process, the environmental impact assessment process. We hired some environmental consultants, one locally out of Halifax and another one out of Newfoundland, who had done some offshore work before and prepared environmental impact assessments. So establishing relationships with them as well and understanding, you know, what we need to do to ensure your environmental impact assessment is, you know, compliant. We've looked at it. We've heard concerns. And potential mitigations for those concerns. So yeah, it was a lot of work in a short period of time to get up to speed. Again, coming back to one of your previous questions, you know, applying a lot of the same principles that I've worked with before in terms of, you know, trying to move projects forward that are complex, are not your run-of-the-mill type projects. And this certainly wasn't one of them either. You know, the public consultation process we went through, and I can talk through more of that. I came from a regulatory jurisdiction in Alberta where, you know, working on, you know, was regulated by the ERCB at that time and now called the AER, but essentially a pretty defined, robust regulatory system where if you, you know, fulfill the requirements, address people's concerns, demonstrate you've done your best, generally, you know, you've got, you know, a pretty good sense that, you know, if you work through that process and you've checked all the boxes, you've done, you know, put a really good regulatory application together based off your public and stakeholder engagement, the chances are you feel pretty good that you'll likely get an approval of some sort, you know, with perhaps conditions. And I didn't know the offshore regulator, like, you know the one that you worked with in Alberta for so long. So it was, you know, did that same thing exist? And, you know, that clarity wasn't there when I jumped into this process. And, you know, even as we worked through it, it was still really up in the air. Mm-hmm. The other thing was, you know, the convincing, you know, the company I worked for that, hey, these are the timelines we're kind of looking at now, given this is going in a public review hearing process. These are kind of the costs we're looking at. Are you guys good with proceeding down this path? And there was, you know, some hard discussions internally, given companies have, you know, lots of places to invest capital, right? Mm-hmm. And how long is this going to take?
I hadn't intended to bring this up, but you reminded me of the tension that can exist inside an organization between the access professional and the technical team or the leadership. You know, you're not always bringing them good news. Was there a bit of that tension involved around the project table, or were people pretty accepting and understanding of the sensitivities you were dealing with?
There was definitely a lot of questions. And of course, there's tension from time to time. And you know, you have to look at it from the perspective, you know, we're looking at acquiring a seismic program. Assuming the seismic looks good, then we're going to go drill a well, which would be great. And it's really the initial step of exploration. And so they're thinking, well, this is simple. And the other thing is the company he's working for has done this all over the world. And so was the partner in the project. It's thinking, well, this is a seismic vessel with air guns. This, you know, the Gulf of Mexico, there's seismic all over the place. And they're thinking, what the heck's different here? Like, what's going on? And, and you know, the questions I was getting internally, like, you're going to spend X amount of dollars in a public review hearing process. And yeah, I had a partner in the project, you know, a small working interest partner who was like, well, we got to pay percentage of that bill. And it was, so there's lots of questions about that, thinking, well, gee, should we go through with this or not? And gee, Glenn, how come we just, you know, can't we just do something to get the approval? And I'm like, well, that's not the way it works, guys. And so, you know, good on the company for supporting the process to kind of see it through. It was certainly, you know, a challenge as I can get into here.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the hurdles. Just highlight for us, you know, what some of the big hurdles were in attempting to get this project approved.
Sure. Well, I already kind of mentioned, Chad, the, you know, we kind of had an undefined process, I would say, more for, you know, these, the inshore fishery, which, you know, you were closer to, you know, the east coast of Cape Breton. And so it, you know, the fact that it got thrown in this public review hearing process, that was undefined. And so that was a big hurdle. Like, what does this thing look like? How long is it going to take? What's the cost? You know, all of a sudden we need to engage legal counsel as well, which, you know, those costs can add up, you know, extensively. The other thing is, you know, we, you know, it's a long ways across Canada from Calgary to Halifax. And so, you know, extensive travel was involved. What kind of resources we needed to put the appropriate resources on the ground. I'd mentioned that we'd hired, you know, a couple of environmental consultants, you know, one out of Halifax, another one out of Newfoundland. And then we also hired an on the ground logistics individual who would set up meetings for us. There was me and my geophysicist at the time who really represented the company, and you needed a company face. Ideally, you know, if you could kind of move down there and spend a lot more time ingraining the community, that would have been the ideal situation, but it wasn't an option, you know, given, you know, how much effort, you know, the company wanted to get through the process, see kind of what come out of that. But I had other responsibilities as well with Hunt, who I was working for. So
how often were you out there, Glenn? How often were you in Nova Scotia?
It was probably, you know, when we were busy, you know, with meetings and whatnot, it was twice a month, kind of spanned over a period of just under 3 years. And, you know, there was breaks in there, you know, sometimes July or August, you wouldn't go down there. There was no meetings happening at that time. But yeah, when we were busy in the thick of things, gearing up to go into the public review hearing process, it was extensive. So, you know, it takes a lot out of you. You're traveling on a Sunday to be there for a Monday morning and for a meeting Monday morning in Halifax, and then another flight up to Sydney, Cape Breton, maybe following that. You spend 4 days up there and then fly home on a Friday or a Saturday. So yeah, it was extensive. Like I say, it went in spurts, and it, you know, when the public, and maybe if you want, I'll just talk a bit about the public review hearing process. So it was announced, like I say, it got put into this process in the fall of 2000, but the actual terms of reference didn't come out until spring of 2001. And so until the terms of reference come out, you really didn't know kind of what the rules are and how this thing was going to work. And so the terms of reference come out, which essentially define the scope as, you know, offshore exploration, seismic and exploratory drilling. And that kind of defined, you know, the scope of the public review hearing process. So the commissioner who was conducting that process, they then had a pre-hearing process in the fall of 2001, where they went around to the various communities and they explained how the process was going to work. Of course, you know, people would show up at some of those meetings. It wasn't the actual hearing, but they were all ready to either present their opposition to it. And most of them, I guess, who probably attended those, you know, were in opposition. And so they were ready to talk about the issues already, but that's really not what it was about. It was at that time, it was about explaining how the public review hearing process will work, what the scope of it is. So then stakeholders could prepare themselves and come back to the actual hearing process, which happened in January of 2002. Yeah, we got into the, if you want, Chad, I'll get into the actual, the hearing. That was interesting in itself. Maybe just prior to that, you know, one of the things I learned right away is that, you know, we did meet with a number of the stakeholders who were opposed to what we're doing and explained to them environmental impact assessment process, potential mitigations that we were considering to try and mitigate, you know, their concerns on tourism and impacts to the fishery. And perhaps, you know, probably the biggest mitigation factor is you conduct the actual, acquire the seismic in kind of November, when there's least amount of fishing going on and tourism operations. And so you really kind of, timing is the biggest mitigation factor. But we realized early on in the process that, you know, those who were opposed to the project, and I respect their position, you know, there wasn't, you know, oil and gas guy from Calgary is not going to change their mind. Mm-hmm. And so we continued with meetings and consultation, and, you know, we started meeting with some of the towns and municipalities and universities, local businesses, the trades unions, you know, people who were unemployed, who had maybe worked in the coal mine or the steel mine in Cape Breton, those businesses who shut down. And we started some engagement with them and, you know, told them what we're proposing. And, you know, they're obviously concerned about, you know, the fishery as well. They wouldn't want to see that industry harmed, but, you know, explained how the environmental impact assessment process worked. And they were like, well, this is interesting. This is done all over the world, why can't it be done here? And if you can mitigate the potential environmental impacts, there could be quite an industry here. You know, up to the hearing in January, which occurred in January of 2002, we kept those meetings full on in the fall of 2001, you know, with whoever wanted to meet with us, whether they were opposed or not opposed or just neutral on it. And we were actually able to convince, you know, some of the mayors and some of the trades union folks, and even a handful of fishermen to come out and participate in the hearing. And, you know, I remember exactly in the hearing, one of key fishermen we met was saying, yeah, I'm a fisherman. I got my two boats out there from May to August. He said, if this thing can go ahead, I'm going to have those boats working all winter doing crew changes for these groups, or, you know, for the exploration company. So it was, that was solid. And the second piece is getting, you know, one of the mayors of the key towns or cities of Cape Breton to come out and say, you know what, providing these companies can mitigate the environmental impacts under their environmental impact assessment, and we can create another industry here, why not? Let's give these guys a chance. Yeah. And so that's really gold. And I've never in any regulatory hearing that I've been in been able to garnish that kind of support. And, you know, it wasn't a lot of it, but it was some, and people who actually lived there, which was key.
I think this is often an overlooked part of the role that we play, you know, when it comes to gaining access. To get that kind of support, you obviously had to develop rapport, develop trust with them, which I imagine you did by, you know, being very transparent and informative with the information you had about the project and the benefits that could be there. But there's a personal aspect to it. Like, business is personal. You can't really take that out of it. And so I think your ability to connect with those people and build that trust is something that was crucial to being able to get that support.
And again, it comes us down to really what we do in the land business is build relationships, right? And whether that's, you know, with external, you know, public people and communities we deal with, or you know, in downtown Calgary with another company we're doing business with, mm-hmm. building relationships. And that's something we were able to do. You know, the opposition who participated in the hearing, there was 140 plus interveners in this hearing. So, you know, it was lengthy. It was the month of January 2. And, but we had, you know, probably a dozen of them in support, you know, not jumping up and down saying this should go ahead. Absolutely. But their message is more, hey, let's trust that our regulatory body, the CNSOPB, knows what they're doing. They've outlined the criteria for environmental impact assessment. If this company can meet, you know, the criteria under there and mitigate the impacts, why not give this a chance and see if we can introduce another industry? And so, you know, that was, you know, that was really encouraging. You know, on the other side, you talk about building relationships. You know, a lot of the opposition who participate in the hearing, you know, you really don't get to know people in an adversarial type process like that. But one of the good things is it was in the month of January of 2002, and there's not a lot going on for tourism in Cape Breton that time of year. But the hotel the only hotel that was kind of open, a restaurant, was in Bedeque, Cape Breton at the Inverary Inn. So a lot of during the day from 8 in the morning till 6 at night, we would be in this adversarial type hearing process. And then, but then the evening you'd run into, you know, some of the individuals who were opposed to the project, and you kind of get to know them on a bit of a personal level and, you know, mm-hmm. who they're from, you know, kind of what makes them tick. And so, you know, from that perspective, it, you actually developed, you know, I wouldn't say friends or anything, but we got a better understanding of some of those individuals who were, you know, opposing the project in the hearing, and kind of get to know them on a personal level.
Yeah. What a huge difference that, like, well, maybe not a huge difference, but no doubt would have some impact.
Yeah. And I think that also perhaps, you know, this hearing went on 15 business days. So pretty well the whole month of January. And so as you kind of got to know them a little bit more on a personal level, I would say there was probably a bit more respect for each other when you're actually in the public hearing process. So.
Sure. Yeah. So Glenn, when you talk about 140 interveners, of those, how many were for and how many were against?
You know, I'd have to go back and probably dig into the details of that, but I would say, you know, probably 2/3 of them were, you know, opposed to it in some varying fashion.
Okay.
Probably half to 2/3 in some varying fashion, whether it was they didn't trust the environmental impact assessment process or they were just concerns, you know, for example, some of the tourism operators come out and saying, you know, we're concerned about our business and, you know, we're therefore we don't want to see it go ahead. But then when you explain to them, hey, well, we're actually would conduct the seismic program in the wintertime, November to February or November to January, like, oh, okay, well, I guess it's, you know, that's not going to impact us then. But they had originally registered as, you know, in opposition to it. And then we probably had a dozen or so combination of fishermen, trades union people who were representing a lot larger group for example, you know, the on the trades union side who represented a lot bigger group behind the scenes that you didn't get to know, who were looking for work and looking for another industry. And so these processes, you got to think too that, you know, a lot of times a silent majority, they're either busy working or they're busy with families. They don't have time to come out and participate in such a process. So,
right.
And so I believe there was more support out there, which you typically, you know, people are just busy with day-to-day lives and don't have time to come out or take time off work to come participate in such a process.
Mm-hmm. So this thing goes to a hearing. I read something, Glenn, when I was just getting myself up to speed a little bit on this, about an ad hoc committee that worked together to, I don't know if it's to address some of the issues. Can you tell us a bit about what that committee was or who they were?
Sure. Yeah. Everybody, and including myself, thinks, well, you know, you go through a public review hearing, you're going to get a decision out of that that's going to say yes or no. And if it's yes, you know, what kind of conditions are attached to it? we concluded that public review hearing process. The report came out in March of 2002, and essentially, you know, the public review commissioner who conducted the report said, yes, maybe no, it was inconclusive. And okay. So, but, you know, she made some specific recommendations, and while that was certainly disappointing and frustrating at the time, because we were really looking for a decision, right? And that's, you know, most proponents, they're looking for clarity or certainty. Hey, can we go do this or not? And, but she came out with some recommendations. And the first one being that, you know, a science review should happen with the appropriate scientific experts. And that should happen to look at the science of this and make sure, hey, is the environmental impact assessment process addressing that? And the second thing that the report said is that all the parties should try to get together in an ad hoc committee to listen to each other's point of view and try and reach consensus. And so, you know, that was, you know, really, it was open-ended and it was frustrating at the time, but okay, well, that was the recommendations that come out of it. So the regulator, the CNSOPB, they established a scientific review process with appropriate scientific experts. You know, we had our environmental consultants and the other operator who was in this process with their license on the west side of Cape Breton, they had put one in. The environmental organizations, they put forth a scientific expert, and they went away and they did their work. And then they established this ad hoc committee, which I participated in on behalf of the company. And there was a couple of environmental organizations, a couple fishermen in there as well, and one individual from the Cape Breton Trades Union. And so, you know, we met throughout the fall of 2002 several times and to try and reach consensus. And at the end of the day, the ad hoc committee did produce a report, the final report, which reviewed all the issues, but essentially the acknowledgement at the end of it was that consensus could not be reached. And that's, you know, some of the you know, environmental organizations and fishery members chose not to sign off on that report because this thing did have to be submitted into the regulator, the CNSOPB. And the science review group, the science experts, they did complete a report as well. And essentially that report said that, hey, you know, it looks like this, you know, this exploration process, you know, could go ahead and proceed safely if mitigation and monitoring measures were put in place. So then both those reports, the ad hoc committee one, the science one, went back to the CNSOPB for review and further consideration. And then in March of 2003, the CNSOPB released this decision allowing seismic and exploration activities to proceed off both the east and west sides of Cape Breton.
So at the end of the day, you did get your approval.
We did. Yeah, we did. And it's, you know, that was, I tell you, it was, I didn't know whether or not, I didn't know what the regulator would do. And I've never been in an ad hoc committee like that trying to reach consensus. We had a facilitator who facilitated those discussions. You know, I think the parties are pretty grounded in their positions and that's how it was. You know, there was some common ground there with a couple of the reps, but, you know, obviously I'm there representing a position that wants to see it go ahead. And I think we can, providing we can meet the regulatory requirements and address the concerns, which I thought we could, it should go ahead. And, you know, then you have the environmental organizations who, you know, some of their positions may be against fossil fuel development altogether and saying, you know, why even start an exploration process? Because we shouldn't be doing fossil fuel development. Mm-hmm. And some who are perhaps just concerned about potential impacts in their fishery and didn't believe that the environmental assessment process could actually mitigate it. So yeah, we got the approval, which was, you know, it was exciting. A lot of work went into it, tremendous amount of work. You know, but I do, you know, feel for the other side who was opposed to it. They obviously have their position on the issues and, you know, at the end of the day, I think any company who just because they get a regulatory approval, they should still try and engage with with you know, those folks who, if they want to, in terms of how then a project actually goes ahead.
Mm-hmm. What, tell us what you're most proud of with the result. And let me maybe be more clear. You got your approval. But I think oftentimes the things we're proud of are the things that occurred during the process, how you definitely would have grown in your character and your ability, given the challenges you had to navigate on this. So, I mean, the end goal was achieved, which is great, but it's all these things that you had to do and in order to achieve that goal that I think oftentimes we look back and go, well, that's where the win was for me. And that's what I'm curious about is, like, what are you most proud of? What do you think, your biggest wins were personally in getting through that?
I think it was, you're right. It wasn't the approval at the end of the day. It was the relationships we developed, and to be able to garnish some support to come out and actually participate in a hearing, whether that was, you know, the mayor of one of the key towns in Cape Breton, or, you know, a few of the fishermen who actually saw the opportunity in what we were proposing, that, hey, you know, beyond me just running my fishing vessel from May to September and have that business, I could actually buy another few more vessels, and I could look at doing crew changes for, you know, for this company to change out crews out to their drilling rig if this thing really takes off. So being able to open their eyes to the opportunity was probably the biggest win for me. Mm. And then actually being able to, you know, like I say, convince those who weren't opposed to it, had concerns, but to actually say, hey, you know, if we trust, you know, the environmental impact assessment work that has been done, why not give these guys a chance and actually see them come out and publicly say that and be questioned on a stand by, you know, some pretty tough opposition, you know, good on them. That was, you know, and they didn't have to do that, but they did because they wanted to see, they didn't want to see the opportunity just drift away. And so that, to me, that was probably the biggest win in that. And then, you know, figuring out early on that, hey, we need to see if there is some support, because there's just too much uncertainty with, you know, the public review hearing process. And if all the public review commissioner hears is opposition, you know, what's a report going to look like? So mm-hmm. at the end of the day, so that was, yeah, that was, and then, yeah, those relationships we built with those people. And so that was key.
Yeah. That's great. Glenn, tell us about your work today. Bring us into the future, or to the present, I should say, and tell us what your work looks like today.
Well, you know, it's still in the resource development business. You know, probably what I learned out of this is really evaluate, you know, the kind of project you're working on. Understand the political risk at the time, in the, you know, what's going on, because I saw that was certainly a risk on this project that I worked on. And really seek to understand the communities from the potentially affected folks you're dealing with out there, and do that early in the process. You know, and sometimes you take a tongue lashing from some of the people who may be opposed to what you're wanting to do, but there's always a message in there, or a key piece of information that you can learn something from, and really seek to find that out. So, you know, lately here, I've been fortunate in my career to work on some great projects, which were complex and challenging. This is just one of them. You know, for the past 5 years, I've been working on a major infrastructure project, pipeline project that's now under construction in Alberta and BC, which is, you know, again, been really interesting to work on, and it's been great to be part of that.
You ever think back to the East Coast project when you're preparing for a meeting on something you're doing today and apply, you know, similar principles or tactics?
Probably not on this pipeline infrastructure project I'm working on. I mean, we're, you know, it has multiple teams that are doing various things on this. But, you know, prior to that, you know, we worked on extensive coal bed methane development in central Alberta. you know, Bashaw, Wetaskiwin area. We set up synergy groups up there, you know, where people had concerns about potential impacts in their water wells. And we worked through that process with them. After that opportunity, I had a work for a company that were active, a heavy oil company active in the oil sands. And we filed two EIA applications up there, worked with a variety of indigenous groups and communities, as well as public stakeholders. So, you know, took a lot of the experience from this Sydney Bite project and applied it to those ones extensively.
Well, one question for you around advice. What advice would you give to a project proponent today that wanted to develop something, whether it's sensitive or not? What kind of advice would you give them?
Well, really seek out and understand the communities and stakeholders you're dealing with. Understand your regulatory risk, your political risk, you know, and redefine your engagement strategy as you move through the process. And don't be afraid to go out and chat with people who might be opposed to what you're thinking about doing. As I said earlier, there's always a message in there you can learn from, and take the time to listen to them. I guess I kind of look at it, you know, I was blessed with two ears and one mouth, and, you know, kind of use those accordingly, right? Park your agenda at the door and do a lot of listening and see where they're coming from. And it's amazing perhaps how you could bring some of those individuals around or open their mind to at least listening a bit better and narrowing what the issues might be.
Yeah, that's great advice. Well, Glenn, thank you. Thanks for coming on the show. This is a first to hear about an offshore project, and I think it's just a good example of the layers of complexity that go along with access. It's not always about, you know, a piece of land. So thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you, Chad. No, it's, I've been very fortunate to been exposed to the kind of projects I have. And, thank you for taking the time to learn about this one.
My pleasure.
Alrighty.
Hey, bye for now.
Have a good day. Bye now.